Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 has had a dramatic effect on American politics, boosting the participation by African Americans and also increasing the number of black elected officials. That is why supporters of the act were so concerned when it came up recently for a review by the United States Supreme Court. For now, the act still stands, but there are many who are worried that some future court could find parts of the act unconstitutional. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk about the Voting Rights Act, its intent, how it works, what the effect has been. And our guest is Laughlin McDonald. He is director of the Voting Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union in Atlanta, Georgia, and has had that job since 1972. He's represented minorities in many discrimination cases, specializing in the area of voting rights. He has argued himself cases before the Supreme Court. He's testified frequently before Congress, also written for scholarly and popular publications on civil liberties issues. His most recent book is A Voting Rights Odyssey, Black Enfranchisement in Georgia. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome for the guest and on the topic. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions welcome. We just ask people to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving along, and please do focus them on the topic. Other than that, callers certainly are welcome. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. McDonald, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I am fine, thanks. And you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. We appreciate you giving us your time. To start, I think we should ask you to talk, basically about the Voting Rights Act. What was it intended to do?
Well, it did a lot of things. There were permanent provisions and there were temporary provisions, but Section 2 is one of the permanent provisions which prohibits the use of voting practices that have a discriminatory purpose or effect. It also abolished literacy tests and other tests and devices for voting. It did it first in the so-called covered jurisdictions, and then it did it nationwide. The most controversial provision was Section 5, which required so-called covered jurisdictions to get federal approval before they could implement any change in their voting practices or procedures. And they could get approval by making an administrative submission to the Attorney General or by filing a declaratory judgment action in the federal district court in the District of Columbia. And whether they took a judicial route or an administrative route, the jurisdiction had the burden of proving that the change would not have a retrogressive effect on covered minorities, and that was the most controversial.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to Section 5 in a moment, because this was the part of the act that really was being argued in this recent case that the court heard.
Yeah.
But just to take a step back, I wonder, can you talk a little bit more about the kinds of roadblocks that were thrown up by government, and particularly we're talking about places in the Deep South, that were designed to try to limit the participation by voting by African Americans?
Well, they just had a laundry list of things. Literacy tests for voting. I mean, it was a crime in most of the jurisdictions in the South to teach slaves how to read and write. So you had after emancipation, you had a large illiterate black population, and to require people to be able to read and write in order to vote, by definition, would disfranchise a huge number of freedmen. They also had onerous durational residency requirements. You had to live in an area for a year or longer in order to be entitled to vote. That had a disparate impact on blacks because after emancipation, they became much more mobile and less likely to be, you know, permanent residents in places because they were moving to look for jobs. You also had the all-white primary. In order to vote in the Democratic primary, you had to be a white person. and the Democratic primary was the only election in the South that really made any difference at all. If you could vote in the general election, it really meant you were not casting a vote for any useful purpose. The South also passed so-called felon disfranchisement laws, and they picked out the laws that would if you were convicted of an offense, that would disfranchise you, that blacks were thought more likely to commit, and it really gives you an insight into the mind of the white Anglo-Saxon to see the kind of laws that they picked as disfranchising ones. It was things like incest, child molestation, wife beating, petty theft, the kinds of things that the robust, white Anglo-Saxon male was thought more likely to commit. Outright murder was not a disfranchising offense in most of the southern states. So, I mean, they used all of these so-called legal measures to take away the right to vote, but they also resorted to terrorism. The Ku Klux Klan was very active in suppressing the black vote. So the South really did about everything that one could think of to suppress the black vote, despite the fact that we had emancipation after the Civil War, we had the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, which in theory granted equal rights of citizenship to blacks, the 15th Amendment, which granted blacks an equal right to vote. But those things were ignored, and the South found a way around them, and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld most of those disfranchising devices.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Laughlin McDonald. He's director of the Voting Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union in Atlanta, Georgia, and has represented minorities in many discrimination cases and specialized in the area of voting rights. And we are talking here in this hour of Focus 580 about the Voting Rights Act, first passed in 1965. It recently came up before the Supreme Court, a key provision of it. It still stands, but there are people who think that possibly some future court might indeed declare that section, and we'll go on and talk some more about that, the Section 5, to be unconstitutional. Justice Roberts seemed to be raising the question of whether or not it was still needed, and we'll talk about that some more too. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk some more about Section 5. This is the primary enforcement mechanism built into the Act, because what it says is that particularly, and it singles out particular places in the country that had the worst discrimination records, and right, said that these places, and I believe that it's 16 states, and there are a few other smaller jurisdictions, but the big pieces are 16 states, and it says that in these places, if you're going to do something that affects how people vote or where people vote, and it could be something as seemingly minor as changing the polling place, what they have to do is go to the government and say, and before doing that, they have to go to the government and say, can we do this? That's what's known as pre-clearance. Do I essentially have that right?
Yeah, there are nine states and seven nine portions states of states, but there are 16 states or parts of states that are covered, but you are correct in describing what Section 5 is all about.
And so it does not cover all 50 states, just these particular places, and it's based upon their prior record of discrimination, and then I guess that's based upon figures showing patterns of minority voting.
Yeah, the trigger is based on whether the jurisdiction used a test or device for voting, and whether based on a prior presidential election, voter participation was depressed, and based on that trigger, these 16 states or parts of states were targeted. But their jurisdictions, most of the jurisdictions with the worst records were in the South, for sure, but there are jurisdictions outside the South that are also covered. Alaska is covered, for example. There are counties in New York State that are covered. There are a couple of jurisdictions in South Dakota that are covered. But the main impact of it was in the South, because that's where the problem was most pronounced.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that the fact that it does not hold in all 50 states and in these particular regions of the country, I suppose that some people have made the argument that that's a problem with the Act.
Yeah, but the act also contains a so-called bail-in provision, and it allows a court that finds a constitutional violation in an uncovered jurisdiction as part of the remedy for the violation to subject that jurisdiction to Section 5 coverage. And there have been a number of uncovered jurisdictions in Florida, several in South Dakota that have been, you know, bailed in, if you will. So there is a mechanism for including uncovered jurisdictions.
Is there also the parallel kind of mechanism for bailing out so that some jurisdiction, some place in the country could say, now look here, based on a record now of some longstanding, going back some years, we can say we have done all the right things. We have made it possible for anybody who wants to vote and who can vote to do that. And so for that reason, we ought to be exempt from this.
Yeah, there is. And I think that, that's one of the things that mitigates the argument that Section 5 is draconian and is unconstitutional, because if a jurisdiction has a clean record, it can bail out. And prior to this recent Supreme Court decision, jurisdictions down to the county or parish level could bail out, and any sub-jurisdiction within a county or a parish that registered voters could also bail out. The Supreme Court in the recent Municipal Utility District case from Austin, Texas, has now said that any covered jurisdiction can bail out. So I think that that mitigates to a large extent the argument that Section 5 is unconstitutional because you can't get out. You can get out if you've got a clean record.
Mm-hmm. Now, the case that triggered this whole conversation was brought by, ultimately, was brought by a small, seeming to me, a small unit of government in Texas. And I referred earlier to some of the kinds of things that you'd have to get preclearance for. And if I remember the details of this, it was, in fact, that what they wanted to do was change the location of a polling place, which seems to be not a terribly onerous or serious thing to do, to move it from one place to another. But to do that, because they're covered, they would have to have preclearance. And essentially what they were asking for was either to be bailed out, or really what they were asking for, and I think probably what a lot of people would have liked to see, was simply to have this declared unconstitutional.
Yeah, I think that, you know, during the in 2005 and 2006, Congress was debating and holding hearings on whether or not to extend Section 5. And I think everybody who participated in those hearings understood that if Congress, in fact, extended Section 5, and if the president signed the law into effect, that somebody was going to challenge the extension, because when Section 5 was passed in 1965, Section 5 would last only for 5 years. Then it was extended in 1970. For another 5 years. Then in 1975, it was extended again until 1982. Then in 1982, it was extended for another 25 years. Then in 2006, it was extended again for 25 years. And after each one of those extensions, somebody challenged the constitutionality of the extension. So everyone knew that there would be a constitutional challenge, and nobody was surprised. I think it was 8 days after President Bush signed the extension into law, this Municipal Utility District filed a lawsuit saying, number one, that it was eligible to bail out, but that if it were not eligible to bail out, then Section 5 was now unconstitutional. And I think it's pretty clear, based on the way that the bailout had been interpreted, that the Municipal Utility District really wasn't entitled to bail out, because it wasn't a county or a parish. It was a subdivision of Travis County, which is where Austin, Texas is, and it did not actually register voters, but the U.S. Supreme Court concluded that it was entitled to bail out, and because it was entitled to bail out, the court found it unnecessary to reach the thorny question of the constitutionality of the extension.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what's important about this outcome, is that clearly this was an invitation to the court to rule on the constitutionality of Section 5, and the court didn't do that. It found another way to look at this, but at the same time, it seems that the door is open at least part way. You know, you look at, for example, what Justice Roberts said about it, where he made some comments saying that he thought that this is not 1965. this is not that time. Things are different in the South. Things are different in American politics. And he seemed to be raising this question, well, do we still need the Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, you know, leading up to the argument, I was fairly convinced that the court was going to reach the issue of the constitutionality of Section 5 and would uphold it. And I really based that on the fact that the prior extensions had been challenged, and on four separate occasions, the Supreme Court had upheld the constitutionality. That in a 2006 opinion, this was just weeks before Congress enacted the extension, the court decided the case Lulac versus Perry, and eight justices wrote opinions or concurred in opinions in which they said that states had a compelling interest in complying with Section 5. Then in 2008, which was now, you know, several years after the extension, the court decided a case involving Section 5, you know, whether or not a change implemented pursuant to a state Supreme Court decision was a voting change covered by Section 5. It concluded that the change had never been implemented and therefore it wasn't subject to Section 5, but no member of the court suggested that Section 5 had doubtful constitutionality, and in fact it was applied. Though I had, you know, thought that there plainly was a majority of votes on the court to uphold the constitutionality, and then I heard the oral argument, and it appeared that the court was split, four willing to uphold the constitutionality, four unwilling to do so, with Justice Kennedy being the deciding fifth vote. Well, the court, as you say, did not reach the constitutionality of Section 5, and I'm inclined to think that the reason the court didn't do that is because they did not have five votes to do so. So you have Chief Justice Roberts writing an opinion. He's writing using his own language, and you don't hear anything, no concurring opinions from any of the other justices, although you do get a dissenting opinion from Justice Thomas. I don't think anybody was surprised at the position that he took. So I think that what that decision means is that there aren't five votes on that court presently to strike down Section 5. And we now have Section 5. It's unscathed thus far, and it will continue to be implemented. I'm confident, though, that somebody down the road will re-raise the challenge to its constitutionality.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Laughlin McDonald. He's director of the Voting Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union in Atlanta, Georgia, has been since 1972. He's represented minorities in many discrimination cases and specialized in the area of voting rights. And we're talking this morning about the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and about this recent case that was decided by the Supreme Court that looked at the act. And as I said, and we've discussed, some people think that that the court might in fact be poised to declare it unconstitutional. That didn't happen, but the possibility remains that some future court might do that. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. First is in Morris on our line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I was just curious, why can't we have a voters' the act changed the bill. If you're an American citizen, you're born here legally, you have legal documentation, then you have the right to vote. It seems to me there's a lot of abnormalities in the voting system now. I did some research on it, and out west seems to have a big problem with a lot of people coming in from places they ought to be, and basically getting your votes. And the same thing with the South. I think there's people that aren't voting because they're being turned away or, you know, some other reason, like you were saying. We're at a time in this country, I think everybody needs to vote. If you're an American citizen, you live here and you pay taxes, you need to vote. And I think there's a lack of interest in that, both in the primary and in the national. And I just don't understand it. Do you see any growth with Barack Obama being in office as far as minority status, or do you see maybe lack thereof still?
I think that there was a huge surge in voter registration and voter turnout as a result of the candidacy of Barack Obama. We saw that not only among African Americans and young people in the South, really significant increases in registration and voting, but we also saw in the West tribal members increase their registration and turnout for the first time in history. So I am told presidential candidates actually campaigned on Indian reservations, and there was a very large turnout there. So I, you know, think that in the past there has been depressed turnout, there's been depressed interest in voter registration, but I hope that that's changing, and it certainly did change significantly during the 2008 election.
Yeah, I hope we're vigilant in our voting. I'm disappointed in the way the American public has basically turned off because they're not interested. I know on the local level that's what happens, but thank you very much, Dave, and
sure.
You guys have a great week.
Thanks for the call. Let's go on to somebody here on a cell phone calling from, I think, Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes. I haven't read the case, but I've read extensive commentary about the Section 5 case. And there seems to be some hint, even though they didn't get to the constitutional issue this time, that there are some suggestions and some opinions that maybe Congress better tweak this act. If it comes up again, there may be five who will say it is not a necessary and proper exercise of congressional power to keep Section 5 in light of the circumstances. One of the circumstances seems to be is that the election of President Barack Obama has sort of ushered us into a post-racial age, which I say is baloney, but that's what I think is becoming a crutch for people like the Roberts Court and people of even people like Justice Clarence Thomas, who is the sole African-American, and he's the sole dissenter here, and he basically said, as I read the commentary, that he believes the Voting Rights Act was no longer necessary because of a change in racial dynamics in this country. How do you feel about this? We elect a black president, and then he becomes a means. His election becomes a means for people to say, as Dr. King, we've overcome racially in this country.
Yeah, I would say two things, that there's no question that Obama's election reflects an advance in race relations. I'm not sure that anyone who was around in 1965 would have thought that they would have seen an African-American elected as president during their lifetime. But having said that, you ought to look at the election statistics and figures which have been analyzed by a number of political scientists. And of the nine southern states that are covered in whole or in part by Section 5, six of them went for McCain: Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas, and the average white vote for Obama was only 18%. So Obama didn't get, you know, huge white support in those states. And I think this is further significant. In some of those states, the white vote for Obama declined compared to the 2004 presidential election. For example, Kerry got 19% of the white vote in Alabama in 2004, but Obama got, well, guess now, 10% in 2008. In Louisiana, Kerry got 24% of the white vote. Obama got 14%. In Mississippi, Kerry got 14% of the white vote, and Obama got just 11%. So Obama didn't get a lot of those white votes in those covered jurisdictions, which indicates, I think, the continuing presence of racially polarized voting and the continued need for Section 5. And the second point that I would make is that there's one of the traditions, lasting traditions in the South, is for somebody to announce that race is no longer a factor and it's all over. And I'll just give you two examples, which are among my favorite. One was Henry Grady, who was the managing editor of the Atlanta Constitution and was a big spokesperson for the New South concept. And he gave a speech to the New England Society of New York in 1886, and he says, quote, "There was a South of slavery and secession. That South is dead. There is now a South of union and freedom." And then he went on to talk about the Negro and said, quote, "He has the fullest protection of our laws and the friendship of our people, but We all know that by the turn of the century, the white South had disfranchised blacks, had replaced slavery with Jim Crow, and had implemented racial segregation in every area of life. And I give one more example. Jimmy Carter was inaugurated governor of Georgia in 1971, and in his speech he said, this is, quote, "The time for racial discrimination is over. Our people have already made this major and difficult decision." Well, Congress amended and extended the Voting Rights Act in 1975 and 1982, and it held extensive hearings, and the conclusion it reached was not the one that Carter had advanced. It did not find that racial discrimination was over. So I think, you know, we've made progress, but there's much to indicate that race still remains dynamic, influences the way people vote. It has an enormous impact on who gets elected and the circumstances under which they do. We haven't outlived or bypassed the whole problems of race.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. If the primary objection that people have is to this section of the Act, Section 5, and the preclearance requirements, and that is, again, it means that essentially if you want to make some change in voting procedures, in where people vote, you're going to have to go to the government in advance to ask, can we do this? And that applies in not everywhere, but it applies, as you said, in parts of 16 states and some other smaller jurisdictions. Is there anyone who has said, well, maybe one way that we can deal with the objections to that is to say this applies to everybody?
Well, yeah, people talked about that, and there were members of Congress in 2005 and 2006 who made the argument that Section 5 should be made nationwide, but that was rejected because that really would make Section 5 virtually unadministratable. I mean, if every single jurisdiction had to make a submission, there'd be no way that the Department of Justice could handle all of those submissions. So that really is not a serious discussion about how to address so-called problems of Section 5. But again, I mean, I think that what the Supreme Court decision holds is that any jurisdiction, parish, county, school board, whether or not it registers voters or not, any jurisdiction that's covered can bail out. And there have been about 17 jurisdictions in the last couple of years that have bailed out, and every single one of them has been able to bail out. And I, you know, suspect that the Municipal Utility District, if it goes forward with an effort to bail out, probably will be able to bail out. So if any jurisdiction wants to get out, they can. I think that one of the interesting things about the allegations that Section 5 is unfair and burdensome is the fact that Travis County, Texas, which is the county in which the Municipal Utility District is located, intervened on behalf of the defendant attorney general to argue for the constitutionality of Section 5, and it did so because it thought that having to pre-clear things was a positive and good thing for all the voters in Travis County. There was not a single covered jurisdiction that intervened on behalf of the plaintiff to challenge the constitutionality of Section 5. There were some amicus briefs that they filed in the Supreme Court. But you don't have, you know, jurisdictions standing up arguing that Section 5 is unconstitutional or seeking bailout, because I don't think they think it's a burden, and they think that it has a lot of positive implications.
Mm-hmm. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. We're a little bit past our midpoint. Our guest this morning, Lachlan McDonald. He's director of the Voting Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, based in Atlanta, Georgia. He's had that job since 1972. He's represented minorities in many discrimination cases, and he specializes in the area of voting rights. He has himself argued cases before the Supreme Court, has testified frequently before Congress. He's written for scholarly and popular publications on civil liberties issues. His most recent book is titled A Voting Rights Odyssey, Black Enfranchisement in Georgia. We have a couple of callers here. We'll get right to them. Let me just give you the number. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we have a caller in the community of Belgium, not too far away, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. My question goes towards a little bit different situation here, if I might explain, where the Voting Rights Act helps individual groups make sure their vote is included. seems with the way our voting system is set up, with the Electoral College, with just strictly a two-party system, and with a media that's influenced by large sums of money in input by either corporations or wealthy individuals, kind of disenfranchises all of us, doesn't it?
Well, the ACLU actually has adopted a formal policy calling for the abolition of the Electoral College, and they have characterized it as a relic of, you know, an aristocratic age where the decision making was given to, you know, a handful of, you know, selected people. The ACLU would like to see a popular vote amendment to the Constitution to replace the Electoral College. So I think that I agree with you that there is something fundamentally anti-democratic about the Electoral College.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone in Rantoul, line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I wanted to say I'm a long-time supporter of the ACLU. Glad you're working with them. My question is, or what I'd like to expand on a little more, is in Section 5, the stipulations that would preclude or allow someone to bail out, some governmental body to bail out, is if they have a clean record. Could you please tell us what a clean record means, who is deciding whether a record is clean, whether this is looked at as being a fairly thorough process that is accurately reflecting what's happening on the ground, et cetera. I'll let you talk to me offline. Thank you.
All right. Excellent question.
Yeah, they have to show that they have not had any Section 5 objections within the preceding 10 years, that there have been no failures to comply with Section 5 during the preceding 10 years, that there have been no findings by a court of voting rights violations within the preceding 10 years, and then they have to show that they've undertaken affirmative measures to promote full electoral participation. And they have to file a lawsuit in the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia, and the lawsuit's defended by the Department of Justice. But the Department of Justice has consented to the bailout of the 17 most recently successful Section 5 bailout. So I think the jurisdiction can fairly easily determine whether or not it's eligible based on its prior record. Mm.
So it's not just that there haven't been any complaints, that they also, in a positive way, have to demonstrate that we have done these things to make access to the vote open for everybody.
Right. That they provided, you know, sufficient polling places and polling workers, and that they've, you know, administered the election laws in a way that promotes full participation.
I want to go back to one of the points that the first caller made, because I think it's a good point, an opportunity for a good question. And I know it is something that the ACLU tracks and is interested in. What sort of roadblocks exist today for people who want to vote?
You know, what we have seen within the past several years, a wave of efforts to depress the vote. We've seen states pass these photo ID requirements for in-person voting. To vote in person, you've got to have a photo ID, and the argument is that that's a way to prevent in-person voting fraud. But there is no evidence, virtually no evidence, of fraudulent in-person voting in the states that have enacted these provisions. Indiana was one of them. Georgia was another. There's never been a single incident of fraudulent in-person voting in Indiana or in the state of Georgia, yet the legislature cites voter fraud as a justification for the photo ID requirement. There is no question that the photo ID requirement will depress the turnout of certain groups, and they are racial minorities, they are poor people, they are disabled people, they are people who can't drive, who don't have photo ID requirements, driver's licenses, for example, or government-issued photo IDs. There's little doubt that those measures depress voter turnout. There also are efforts to pass these proof of citizenship requirements. I mean, a person ought to be able to sign an oath saying, I swear under oath, subject to being convicted of a felony, that I am a citizen of the United States. But that's not enough. These jurisdictions require you to get birth certificates. They require you to get a lot of other data or identification requirement, and the people who tend not to have those are poor people, people who were born during a time when there were no birth certificates being issued, and there's no question about the adverse impact that that will have. We also have seen a wave of vote suppression measures that have been undertaken in various states, and I'll give you one example that comes from Montana. The Republican Party took the U.S. Postal Service change of address registry and compared it to the list of registered voters in predominantly Democratic counties, and they challenged thousands of voters who had a mismatch on the grounds that they were no longer residents. Well, the Democratic Party filed a lawsuit in federal district court. After the lawsuit was filed, the Secretary of State announced that he was not going to process these challenges, and the federal district court subsequently issued an opinion in which it said that since these challenges were not going to be processed, there was no reason for the court to issue any order, but it made an express finding that the challenges were partisan-driven. And we know that Republicans in the past several elections have resorted to similar database matching challenges. One of the things that they did in Virginia a couple of years ago was to get the voter registration lists from majority black precincts, and they sent letters to each of the black voters in these precincts with "do not forward" instructions on the letter, so that if they were not delivered, they were returned to the Republicans who sent them, and they would then use those systematically to challenge black voters. So, I mean, we think that the right to vote is fundamental. The Supreme Court constantly uses that phrase. It's fundamental because it's protective of all rights. The right to vote is protected by more constitutional amendments than any right that we have, the First Amendment, the 14th and the 15th and the 19th and the 24th and 26th. And yet we still see efforts and the willingness on the part of political parties and state legislatures to attempt to suppress the vote. And it's one of the great scandals in our American democracy, I think.
Mm. Well, just to go back to the earlier question about what is appropriate to ask people to do to show that they're qualified to vote,
right.
How does one set that bar so that it is appropriate so that we can determine if someone wants to vote or someone wants to register to vote, that they are who they say they are and they live in this particular place and that there's no reason under law they should be not denied the right to vote? How do you draw the line between what is appropriate to ask them to say and to present and what is burdensome?
Well, I think that people should be required to sign an oath representing that they are who they say they are, that they are citizens of the United States, whether naturalized or native-born, that they are residents of the place where they say they are, that they're 18 years of age or older, that they have not been convicted of a disfranchising offense, that they've not been declared incompetent by a competent court to vote. And I think if you sign that oath subject to being found guilty of a felony, if you misrepresent the facts, that that's enough to ensure that people who vote are properly entitled to vote.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking about the Voting Rights Act, first passed in 1965, and we have been talking some about a recent decision by the Supreme Court that raised some questions about the act. And would it continue to stand? It does. But as we have discussed, and some people think, there is this possibility that a future court might find a key provision of the act unconstitutional. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Laughlin McDonald. He is with the American Civil Liberties Union, has been with the organization for a number of years now. He's director of the Voting Rights Project of the ACLU in Atlanta. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And I believe that we have another caller here to bring into the conversation, somebody who is on our line number one, I think calling from Yorkville up in the northern part of the state. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just had a question. I always hear these statistics pointing out racism because whites only voted for Barack Obama 18% or 14%. I rarely hear the statistics on the other side of overall how many blacks voted for John McCain, and is that racism if they're under 18%?
Well, you know, when people vote, that's not, you know, state action. You can vote however you wish, but racially polarized voting is important because it interacts with the electoral system that exists. And if that interaction allows the majority consistently to deprive the minority of the equal opportunity to participate and elect candidates of choice, then that runs afoul of the law. But it's not the voting itself. That's private behavior. You can vote however you want. But if it interacts with an electoral structure, then that can trigger a statutory or a constitutional violation.
Well, that was not my question. My question is, for the ACLU, I hear the charge of racism because not enough whites voted for Barack Obama. Is it reverse if not enough blacks voted for John McCain?
Well, my comment about the figures is that that's in response to claims by people that race no longer is a factor, that there is no longer a division in the way that people vote. And I'm saying that those figures show that there is, that we know that the process is driven by race, that whites will vote white and that blacks are politically cohesive and they will tend to vote for blacks, for a black candidate. They voted overwhelmingly for Obama. I'm not denying that in the least, but I recite those figures because there are those who say that those patterns no longer exist, and I'm saying that they do.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I tell you, I usually hear one side of it. That's because I think if I remember the national figure, it was 7% of blacks voted for McCain.
Yeah, okay, you know, I would say to make out a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits voting practices that deprive minorities of an equal opportunity to elect candidates of choice, there are, you know, two things that you must show initially, and one is that blacks are politically cohesive, or the language minority is politically cohesive. That is, that they tend to vote as a bloc. And secondly, you have to show that whites are also politically cohesive and that they vote as a bloc, usually to defeat the candidates favored by the minority. So the voting patterns of both races is critical to the inquiry about racial fairness.
Just a little bit earlier, you were talking a little bit about some cases of the kinds of roadblocks. I know I keep using that cliche, but get thrown up for people who want to vote. One of the things that I am interested in, I'm looking here at some of the things on your website, some of the litigation that you've been involved in, have to do with the exclusion of people from voting who have been convicted of crimes.
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit about that? What does the law say about a person's criminal record and their right to vote? And then in what way has ACLU been involved in this?
Well, the states don't have to. The states establish the conditions for voting, and that means you've got to be a resident, you've got to be a citizen, you've got to be 18 years of age or older, and you can't have been found disqualified to vote by a court of competent jurisdiction. And many states have adopted laws that disfranchise people convicted of felonies. And there's a patchwork system of laws. In some states, you're permanently disfranchised once you get convicted of a felony. Some states don't deprive you of the right to vote, even if you have been convicted of a felony. Most states say that while you're actually serving your sentence, you can't vote. But once you are released from prison and from probation and parole, you can vote. Others say, well, you can vote, but only if you've paid restitution or child support payments. So it's really a crazy quilt of disfranchising schemes that exist out there. But there is little doubt that felon disfranchisement deprives people of the right to vote. And I think that I'm not so naive or innocent as to think that that once you release a person from jail or prison and you give them the right to vote, that they're going to, you know, go down the straight and narrow path and be totally rehabilitated. But I think that it's one of the things that promotes rehabilitation. I mean, if you permanently disfranchise someone and ostracize them from participating in the political process, I don't think that that helps them get rehabilitated. So the ACLU strongly supports removing disfranchisement for conviction of offenses. One of the big problems is that the Supreme Court decided a case in the 1970s, Richardson versus Ramirez, in which it said that Section 2 of the 14th Amendment provided an affirmative sanction for states to disfranchise people who are convicted of felonies. So you can't successfully challenge the disfranchisement of people convicted of felonies under the 14th Amendment, although there have been a couple of cases since Richardson versus Ramirez, one of which came from Mississippi, in which the court said that the offenses that were disfranchising were chosen on a racially discriminatory basis, that offenses were picked which blacks were thought more likely to commit than whites, and the court said, therefore, that state scheme was tarnished with racial discrimination and invalidated it. But that wouldn't keep the state from enacting something that was not racially tarnished. Then in a case from Alabama, the court invalidated a law there which disfranchised males guilty of wife beating, but it didn't disfranchise women who were convicted of beating their husbands. And the court said that was a gender-based classification, and it was unconstitutional because the state hadn't shown any compelling interest for discriminating on the basis of sex. Well, the state could remedy that by simply saying that the spousal abuse was disfranchising. You're right. We have a lot of litigation in the pipeline now, in which we are arguing that the affirmative sanction recognized in Richardson versus Ramirez only extends to felonies that were felonies at common law, and there are about a dozen of those. So that all of these felonies that were enacted statutorily, drug offenses, for example, there would be no affirmative sanction because they weren't felonies at common law. The courts have not been very receptive to those arguments, but we are proceeding with them because we think that the right to vote indeed is fundamental, and that at a minimum, once a person has served their time in prison or jail, that they ought to be able to return to voting and participating in mainstream politics.
And while a state apparently may bar people convicted of felonies from voting on the state level, that is, for voting for statewide office, it is my understanding, though, that they may not bar someone from voting, say, for president of the United States.
No, they can prohibit you from...
They can?
Yes.
Oh.
Now, some states do make that distinction, and despite the fact that the state law makes that distinction, people are being denied the right to vote anyway, and we're challenging that in one of the states.
Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I guess I want to come back because we started out, we decided we wanted to have the conversation so we could talk a little bit about this recent case in the court, Supreme Court. And you said that we talked about the fact that the court really avoided making the decision on the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. And you said you thought it was because the determination was made by the Chief Justice that or someone that there weren't enough votes to strike it down. Now, that leaves open the possibility that sometime in the future there might. You explained the fact that every time the act was renewed, and it has been renewed a number of times, most recently 2006, somebody has come forward to challenge it. Do you think that it's likely now things will be quiet for a while, or would it take some kind of significant change in the makeup of the court for someone out there in the country to think that it might be time again to raise the issue?
I would just be speculating. I can't tell you what goes on in the minds of folks who are out there. But after the various amendments in 70 and 75 and 82, there were challenges, and they reached the Supreme Court, and then there were no challenges after that until the next reauthorization took place. I don't know whether that pattern will repeat itself or whether we'll see additional challenges, but I think one thing that would make a subsequent challenge more difficult is that the Supreme Court has significantly expanded the bailout provision. So one of the arguments that you could make is, well, once you're there, you're stuck and you can't get out, plainly has been taken away. So I think that argues and is an additional argument for the constitutionality of Section 5. But I, was not the fly on the wall in the Supreme Court chamber when the justices discussed the opinion and what the ruling would be, but I become more convinced the more I think of it that there weren't five votes, and I don't think there will be five votes in the foreseeable future. I don't think that Sotomayor, if she is confirmed, which I believe that she will be, I don't think that she would change the vote on that at all, and Kennedy would remain in the middle, and I think he's probably not ready to cast that negative vote.
Well, there we must stop with our thanks to our guest, Laughlin McDonald. He's director of the Voting Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union in Atlanta, has been since 1972. Want to read up more about voting rights or other sorts of civil liberties issues, you take a look at their website, which is www.aclu.org. Mr. McDonald, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.